Hello and welcome to this episode on The Road to Middle-earth, the history and inspirations behind Tolkien's Legendarium, specifically looking at the Third Age, so covering The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings, our first foray into Tolkien studies on this channel. I'm very lucky to be joined by Nathan Hurd. Hello, sir.
Hello, great to be here and be discussing such a wonderful topic with you.
Wonderful. And if you haven't done so, do check out Nathan Hurd's channel. He's got a video dedicated to Tolkien's essay on fairy stories, which I very much recommend. Regarding sort of starting this conversation, maybe we should start by looking at Tolkien himself. Are you okay with giving like a brief summary of Tolkien?
You go for it. You go for it. I'm still collecting my notes here at the moment.
All right. Well, the main source for this evening is going to be The Road to Middle-earth by Tom Shippey, which I've got linked in the bottom. And he uses a quote from Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream to really sum up his making of the Lord of the Rings. "But all the story of the night told over, and all their minds transfigured so together, more witnesseth than fancy images, and grows to something of great constancy, but however strange and admirable." And what he is getting at there is describing how the Lord of the Rings isn't some, you know, or you can almost say it's an incidental work of great fantasy. It is the culmination of 60 years of philological and, you know, historical enterprise on the part of Tolkien, who was, you know, principally a philologist. And, you know, what is a philologist? It's sadly academic discipline which has fallen out of favor, but was very prominent in the 19th century and was declining during the professorship of Tolkien, who was first a professor at Leeds and then a professor at Oxford. Philology in Greek literally means, you know, the love of talk, or, you know, the love of learning. But really it comes to the formation of words and the history of words and seeing language as some sort of historic continuity. And so there's, you know, something interestingly and very fundamentally reactionary about that. And of course, the purist element, the perfectionist element of Tolkien, came to trying to understand and figure out a pure form of Old English and, as an extension, Old English mythology. So he was very much engage in Old Norse mythology and Germanic mythology. In particular, he was fascinated with the Goths. And one of his, you know, great studies throughout his life was the study of Beowulf. And he wrote, you know, copious essays, you know, children's books such as, I've forgotten off the top of my head now, but getting to The Hobbit, you know, he was a very prolific academic and children's author. You could almost ascribe to him, you know, characteristics of a 20th century version of Jacob Grimm, of Grimm's fairy tale fame in Germany, who of course was both a great reviver and reconstructor of the ancient Germanic fables, and of course very influential in his contributions to the German language as well, the understanding of the history of the German language, which, interestingly enough and quite coincidentally, we covered on our stream last week. Is there anything else you would like to point out, Nathan?
Just a couple of things. One of the books is Farmer Giles of Ham?
Yes, Farmer Giles is the one I was thinking of, yeah.
Ham, Birmingham, where Tolkien grew up. And I think that's something we might come across, is many of his life influences, or where his surroundings are somewhat featured in The Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit. He's drawing on his experience of where he's been. But just also to add on to the philology aspect and how this connects very strongly with his fantasy writing, in his essay on fairy stories, Tolkien makes the point that language is of itself always has an imaginative character, because you're assigning certain words to certain objects in the world, and you can mix and match those words, and there's a metaphorical component to that. It's always transforming what you're talking about. And so if you're interested in language, you're inherently interested in mythology for Tolkien. The two go hand in hand, and the storyteller kind of brings these two together. So I think it, in his view, it was a very natural transition for him to write something like The Lord of the Rings, whereas maybe to many of us today, it seems like a world apart, being a scholar of language and a great fantasist.
Well, the ironic thing is that you could say that the Lord of the Rings universe was an exercise in the construction of languages. You know, one of his great extracurricular activities, of course, we mentioned the fact he was a philologist, but was a way of importing his own constructed languages into some sort of, again, overarching structure. And the fascinating thing is, you know, the extent to which this influences the world. Say, for example, the Rohirrim, which is something we'll cover hopefully in quite a lot of depth, how the Rohirrim are sort of, again, incidental almost as a result of Tolkien's fascination with the Gothic language and the Old English language. Interestingly enough, the you could say the consistency of language as being the central theme, or constructed language being the central theme in Tolkien's work, really breaks down once you include aspects of the Shire. Because the Shire is really relatively anachronistic in terms of the overall structure. It's especially considering that Tolkien was so fastidious in understanding that there had to be some sort of living, again, mythological continuity with the words, and yet within the Lord of the Rings universe itself. I think this is also the effect of him, again, having written The Hobbit and not necessarily considered that The Hobbit would lead anywhere, definitely not to Lord of the Rings. But you have the coexistence of Old Norse, as you know, exemplified by the dwarves in Middle Earth. You have Old English, as exemplified by the Mark, the Rohirrim, and you have a more modern variation of English in the form of the Hobbits. So all of these languages, which really should feed off and contribute to each other at different time points, existing in the same universe. And I feel that, you know, we're not going to get into characters today, just for a little introduction. This is very much going to be a world-building stream before we get into the characters, hopefully at a later date. But I really feel that when we talk about the Hobbits, I mean, the Hobbits are a invention of Tolkien. I mean, the etymology of Hobbit is holbiat, which I think in Old English means hole dweller. And there's a wonderful sort of apocryphal story of him marking an undergraduate essay or something and just doodling in his notes saying there once was a happy little hobbit who lived in a hole. That's where we get the etymology. Am I wrong there?
No, I think that's correct, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So yes, in terms of the Middle Earth itself, I think, you know, obviously we're talking a lot about philology. It might help to contextualize this conversation on Middle Earth by actually looking at the etymology of Middle Earth itself, because, of course, there is an etymology to it, which is Midengard in Old English, which comes from the Christ poems by Kynwulf. And the significance of the concept of Midengard, of course, it comes from the Norse concept of Midgard, which is basically the land that dwells, and again, I have a picture here, the land that dwells between heaven and hell, essentially, where all the races of men reside, you know, it being basically a melting pot of all the human beings. And of course, in Tolkien's world, the whole conception of Middle-earth is based on a fictionalized version of Earth itself. He very much wanted to create almost like a prehistory of Earth. And he called this territory Arda. You know, at some point there is a conception of Arda, which is flat. And then you have the division of Mittengard or Middle-earth away from Valinor, which is considered to be the, again, the land of the primordial sort of godly beings, you know, the king of which being Ilúvatar. Would you have anything to say on the origins of the concept? Again, it's very rich in mythology, the concept.
I'd only add that there's another poem that it may come from, which is The Wanderer. There's a line or two. I've got it open in front of me. Sorry, I can't give you an exact number, but as now in diverse places in this Middle Earth, walls stand tugged at by winds and hung with hoarfrost, buildings in decay. And this is a poem that actually, so it's an Anglo-Saxon poem that Tolkien will actually quote nearly verbatim in, I think it's The Two Towers. I'll give you a couple of lines and you may recognize them. Where has the horse gone?
Yeah.
Where the man? Where the giver of gold? Where is the feasting place and where the pleasures of the hall? So this poem, with its kind of sense of decay and the kind of the fading of the world, or all that was good in the world, seems to be tied in with this notion of Middle Earth, which he's with it as well for Tolkien, that it's a place of where there were great things, there was a great mythology, maybe tied to the elves and the Valar, as you've mentioned, but there's a changing of the guard, there's a new age coming to be, certainly by the time of the Lord of the Rings.
Yes, and again, this is quite a significant theme. I mean, when reading this, I'm reading this very much as a history. In terms of how the elves fit in, again, as with the dwarves, they represent much more of the mythological aspects. When it comes to the dwarves in particular, there is one sort of claim I want to make about Tolkien in terms of his overall influences, which is that of the Nibelungenlied, the Song of the Nibelungen. And again, the obvious influence from Wagner. Of course, I think the frustration when looking at the inspirations behind Tolkien is that he would famously say that, you know, he abhorred allegory. And I think what he really means by that, you can infer so much in the way of allegory from Tolkien. So I think what Tolkien was very successful in establishing was that he would never establish a direct allegory to any other work, even though, as you mentioned, he would often lift pieces from his primary sources verbatim. And there would be, you know, in terms of sort of overall thematic goals, there would be sort of very much similarities. So, for example, when it comes to, you know, the Nibelheim, you know, the dwarf-like Nibelungens, you know, crafting precious metals, and Tolkien so much would despise the idea that there was any association between Wagner, that he would hold up the ring, you know, say the ring, you know, it's round, and that's where the similarities cease. Which is rather interesting, but yeah, and again, he also has significant criticism also of Hans Christian Andersen and Shakespeare. But I think it's important to note that they both share the same sort of source material, which is, you know, the Poetic Edda and the Nibelungenlied. I mean, mentioning the elves, in terms of sort of understanding what the elves are, of course, you mentioned you know, Valinor. And, you know, I mentioned Ilúvatar, who, you know, you could consider to be, you know, the primordial god. If we were to make a pagan ascription to him, we would refer to him as, you know, Zeus, or even probably, you know, even more primordial than that, such as Saturn or Uranus. When it comes to, you know, all these successor gods, so we have the Ainur, the Valinor, and the Maia, I think it's important to note that, you know, in Christian thinking, you again could ascribe their motives to that of angels, but of course in pagan mythology to that of minor gods. But the elves themselves, I would say, are quite distinct. I mean, on my last stream, I was mentioning that, of course, the elves are a significant aspect of Germanic and therefore Norse mythology at the same time. And unlike the gods, essentially, or especially the Christian angels, the elves in pagan mythology were represented as being rather ambivalent towards the fate of man. There's definitely a view which is, you know, expressed quite extensively in Tolkien, how the elves, there isn't a established opinion. I think this is, again, quite successful of Tolkien, that throughout all the races we encounter, especially at the Council of Elrond, there are very much varying different views of the elves, you know, especially the dwarven antipathy for the elves. So they don't have this, you know, what would be the word, hero worship established for them. They are very much a mysterious race in the same way that they were depicted in Germanic mythology. You know, again, the consistency between that being their almost supernatural beauty, of course, and their, you know, purity in their, again, when we introduce Galadriel, this idea that they will sort of bewitch and bring forth, you know, ill fortune and illness. Interestingly, again, I understand that there is some sort of overlap when Christianity arises in Germany between the transitioning of elves into demons. And with, you know, the language, again, looking at the etymology of these words, we have Orkneias, which in the, you know, old Germanic languages means demon born. Of course, you know, ascribing that to the fact that they are supposed to be corrupted elves and the fact that elves would become demons, I think there's, you know, quite a lot of baggage there in terms of the etymological continuity. Do you have anything to say on that? I've again very quickly summarized the broad inspiration for that.
I guess I would just add that I think a really key idea for Tolkien with the elves is their immortality in contrast to human mortality. And this is something that he often plays with, and how both are curses in their own way, and both in some ways envy the other. And immortality shapes the elves in terms of they're tied to the decline of the world. They see it at its height and they fade away with as nature fades, and as it were, magic fades from the universe.
Mm.
Whereas humanity, or men, as Tolkien would say, are being mortal, are free from the cycles of the world. They're not bound to the flow of time or kind of nature, as it were. And mm. he's touching on this dislocation that he thinks we all feel as humans from nature, that we're in some way alienated and we desire fellowship with the world. Elves have that in some way. They have a, so as you mentioned Galadriel, she has she's attuned to the wood of Lothlorien. They're kind of bound up with each other, the elves and that wood. And I think you could say the same too of those elves in the Silmarillion that you mentioned.
And also
whereas men don't have that. None of the men in Lord of the Rings have that affinity with nature. And I think the hobbits are the most clear example, actually, of this. Because you were mentioning that they're kind of anachronistic or a strange phenomenon in the world of Middle-earth. They don't quite fit in with all the kind of derivations of language. Well, that makes sense because they are a branch of men. They don't belong properly, or they're not tied to nature in the same way the elves are, or the dwarves are to the mountains.
Well, I think the claim I would make against hobbits, particular, is I would compare them directly to the other races of men. I mean, when it comes to languages in particular, and again, seeing the Lord of the Rings as an extension of essentially, you know, Tolkien's playground to establish a world for his constructed languages, like a proper philologist, not only does Tolkien construct these languages, but the languages have a history in themselves. So we start off with, as far as my earliest understanding of, you know, his creator languages, it goes even further back than Noldorin, but then it goes to Sindarin and then Quenya. When it comes to the men, especially the Numenoreans, so the Gondorians, the post-Numenoreans, there is very much an affinity in terms of, you know, when we first are introduced to Faramir, in the Two Towers, it's this that they are speaking, I think they're speaking Quenya. This idea that it forms some sort of lingua franca throughout the world, and there are some sort of there's some sort of affinity with the older races and some sort of cultural attachment. And again, you see this substantially with all of the names, especially of the House of Eanor and the House and the various houses of Gondor. You see it much less with the Rohirrim. But I think the comparison I would make is not necessarily that the hobbits are anachronistic to just the elves, but they're anachronistic towards, you know, most of the elements, almost as if they are a kind of like an ode to sort of early modern England, English society in a way, even though, you know, in terms of their political structure, for example, they're very loose political structure, you know, under a nominal thane who doesn't really exist at this point, especially towards the end of the Third Age, you know, supported by the Dúnedain, that they do represent some sort of, paradoxically, despite their language, you know, even their custom, like eating potatoes and smoking pipeweed, which have again very much interaction with the new world factors, if we are to assume that, you know, pipeweed is tobacco, that regardless of this, and despite the fact that Tolkien would try and utilize, you know, his own language, such as that of taters, to try and facilitate the use of such things as potatoes in the Lord of the Rings universe, I do think it sort of represents some sort of pre-Norman conquest idyll, and very much, I think, you know, a constant theme throughout Tolkien is his desire to find some sort of, again, untampered, unbesmirched English culture or English language, you know, such that existed between the 6th and the 11th centuries. One of the interesting influences pertaining to the hobbits in particular, which again make them sound more anachronistic and alien, was the fact that he was quite influenced, especially in terms of the naming conventions of the hobbits, with that of America. So, say, for example, you know, West Virginia, the Appalachian Hills, and Kentucky. And very much, I think, he was quoted as thinking that this represented, again, a form of English parochialism, you know, across the continent, which wasn't ensnared to a form of, you know, Latin imperialism.
That's fascinating. I had no idea about that. But it makes no sense, given many of those names come from early modern England. Mm. They have their roots that way. And I think Thomas Law's done a lot of work on that, actually, with the language of the deep self was actually from England.
Yes, absolutely.
I have, just while we're on the point of kind of influences on the Shire, I've got an image from somewhere where Tolkien grew up that I could share.
Put it up and I'll put it up on the screen.
Let's see. So this is actually where the Middle Earth Festival takes place, or it did take place every couple of years or so. And it's Sarehall Mill, which is an area nowadays is part of Birmingham, but it would have been its own village at the time. And this mill goes back to the it's an early modern mill, and it was rebuilt in the Georgian era. But as you can see, it just looks like the Shire, pretty much, as you would imagine it. And around this area is lovely green flowing fields with lots of lovely trimmed hedgerows all around. So I think, and this is close to where Tolkien grew up. So there's a possible influence here on how he envisioned the Shire to look like. And given what you said about the early modern connection, this mill being early modern, I don't think that's totally lost on, would have been lost on him either. Oh. Is everything working? Doesn't seem to be working.
Hello. Sorry, the image I've got up is an image of Peter Jackson's Hobbiton. I wasn't able to find your mill image. Do you have to share it with me in the StreamYards, and then I can put it up for you? This would just be a placeholder image. Nathan? Can anyone hear me? Yes, Nathan, I can hear
you're
you.
You're back.
Yes.
You're back.
Yes.
I don't know what happened there. I think I won't try and share again. Don't worry.
All right.
I'll drop the link in the chat.
Well, this will be a placeholder for now. Even though, you know, it's a total reconstruction. It's not the real thing. But nevertheless, you know, continue talking about the hobbits.
Well, I don't know what was picked up or not, but essentially Sarehall Mill is close to where Tolkien grew up. It was an early modern mill that was reconstructed or rebuilt in the Georgian era, and it just looks like the Shire. And around it is lovely flowing green fields with lots of trimmed hedgerows. And the people of that area of Moseley, which wasn't part of Birmingham at that time, Tolkien thought were kind of simple, honest, hardworking folk, maybe a wee bit kind of stuck in their ways and their customs, but nevertheless, they were kind of decent folk. And that just sounds like the Shire to me, or at least it was a little pocket of that kind of early modern society you were talking about that Tolkien grew up around.
Well, the wonderful thing, I think this is quite a good segue to get on to the sort of broader story when we're talking about The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings. Tom Shippey refers to Bilbo in particular, even though, again, this isn't a character-driven stream. I think it would just be interesting, again, talking about our overall subject on Hobbits, that he was very much a bourgeois burglar, essentially in the sense that even the word, you know, burglar, even though I think it means... it just means sort of homebreaker or, you know, something like that. Because, you know, of course, Berg is the originator of home, hence where we get Berger, which means, you know, city. But nevertheless, there's something again even more sort of anachronistic of the fact that he does, you know, maintain such a well-to-do home at Bag End, you know, with his pantries, with his meat delivered, etc. And then, of course, you have these dwarves, which are, in terms of their direct inspiration, they're basically lifted out of the Volupsa, which is another Norse saga poem, and he's taken on again an adventure which, you know, could have happened 2 millennia before, which is very much what I mean by anachronistic. So I think if that's all right, would you like to talk about the themes regarding the Hobbit in particular before we get to Lord of the Rings?
Sure. So, do you want to give me to give a wee summary of the Hobbit?
I don't mind giving a wee summary of the Hobbit. So, Gandalf and the party of Thorin Oakenshield, you know, arrive at Bag End. And this precipitates, you know, an adventure across, you know, through the Lonely Mountain, where Bilbo would interact with Gollum and find the One Ring. The adventure, you know, would continue through Mirkwood, and the process of this adventure is to reach the Lonely Mountain, or to reach Erebor. Erebor had been taken away from the dwarves, having been a dwarven kingdom, and become the domain of the fire drake Smaug. And near, of course, you have the old city of Dale and the city of Lake Town, you know, have suffered considerably as a result of Smaug. The reason that Bilbo is you know, entreated into this party of dwarves led by Thorin is because he can essentially sneak in undisturbed. And again, we'll see this when we get to Erebor. He's very effective at breaking in, but also there's this wonderful conversation which he will have with Smaug. And in terms of, again, the influences of that conversation, that again is lifted straight out of the poetic Edda, that is very reminiscent of Siegfried's conversation with Fafnir. And again, talking about the Wagnerian influence, of course, Tolkien would, you know, be very derisive because Wagner used secondhand sources, and Tolkien would go for the real thing. In Wagner's, of course, that would be Siegfried and Fafnir. And of course, you know, as with everything Tolkien, there is a tiny element of subversion when he's lifting these aspects from ancient myth. So it's not Siegfried lying over the corpse of, you know, a dying Fafnir. No, he's tricking and again trying to play to the narcissism of the dragon. And again, this leads to dramatic consequences when he's unleashed on Lake Town. And in terms of, again, the little subversive aspects of this, we mentioned Beowulf and the significance that Beowulf would have on Tolkien's understanding of ancient Anglo-Saxon Saxon culture. Well, of course, Beowulf, after you have, you know, him arriving and slaying Grendel and Grendel's mother, you have the dragon again coming back again ostensibly because you know, gold had been stolen from him, and, you know, wreaking havoc, and Beowulf would have to lose his life, you know, fighting against the dragon. Nevertheless, little tiny subversions in that story, even though you see so much of that in addition to Thor fighting I believe it's the Nimhog in Ragnarok, which is, you know, the end of the world in Norse mythology. You know, Thorin Oakenshield, you know, wouldn't die as a result of the dragon, and the man responsible for slaying Smaug would, of course, be Bard. So all of these tiny, and again, the interaction being with Bilbo, who is not by any, you know, measure a traditional hero. So all of these tiny little subversions that make the Hobbit familiar and yet unique at the same time.
That's a really lovely summary. And I guess underlying the story, I mean, there's a few themes, but one of them in particular is home, or place of home. So for Bilbo, constantly throughout the story, Tolkien will just drop in a line or two where it's like Bilbo was thinking of being back at home, drinking cups of tea. And the quest for the Lonely Mountain is for the dwarves to reclaim their home from the dragon. You have the men of Dale who have been forced out of Dale, essentially, to live on Lake Town, and they can't go back because the dragon's too close. You have the dwarves and Bilbo pass through many homes. They pass through the goblin's home, Gollum's home, the elves of Mirkwood's home. And so there's this sense throughout of home being a really important thing and worthwhile fighting for. At the same time, leaving home, in the case of Bilbo, is what breaks him out of his prudish, kind of stifled life, where he's worried about plates, about having too many dwarves in his house, rather than kind of embracing life.
Mm.
And through leaving home, he becomes courageous. And I think, well, there's the, you know, there's the often quoted hero's journey or whatever, which, you know, whether Tolkien would ever have believed in such a thing is another question.
I think Joseph Campbell was contemporaneous to Tolkien. I'm sure, you know, Joseph Campbell, again, I'm not that familiar with Joseph Campbell, but nevertheless, he would have certainly been familiar. In terms of, again, you mentioned, I do, you know, of course, in Tolkien's early life, he was a commander in Flanders, of course, during the war from 1915 onwards. And I think it's very much, I do see some sort of, you know, analogy with himself in terms of this country idyll, this almost, you know, parochial mindset, this again, something which is very consistent about the hobbits, is that they are distrustful of outsiders. You know, they're very much clued on to anything which, you know, something which, word which we consistently used, queer, you know, anything, you know, remotely foreign. And very much we see, you know, the Hobbit grow, Bilbo grow as a result of this. But I feel there's almost a link between that and Tolkien's own experiences leaving and joining the war. But again, that's a rather trite and obvious comparison to make.
It is, but it speaks to the humanity of these stories, I think, which is in part what makes them so wonderful, that he's blending not only his own experiences and those of the ordinary people around him, and not only this great mythology that you've just gone through about all these links with Beowulf and Norse mythology, but he's marrying it together. And it's that combination which, it brings so much joy to many of us.
Yes, absolutely. I think, again, The Hobbit, it's fascinating in a way because there's this misconception, again, that the Lord of the Rings was planned. And the interesting thing about the backstory regarding Lord of the Rings is that, of course, you know, in terms of the major crossover, it is the fact that we have the Ring of Power is discovered by Bilbo in the Misty Mountains. But, you know, very much it was almost designed as a MacGuffin in the original, you know, conception process of The Hobbit. And by a MacGuffin, I mean it was essentially to equalize the usefulness of Bilbo as relative to that of the dwarves, you know, to give him that little edge by being able to turn invisible and to add to his, you know, abilities as a burglar. When it comes to Lord of the Rings in particular, it acquires this, you know, again, this entirely new meaning, and, you know, with all the rich sort of thematic elements to do with it in terms of, you know, Acton's proverb of, you know, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. In addition to, you know, many other sort of thematic elements to it. But I don't think, you know, when Tolkien invented the ring, and again, this is why I'm easier on him, you know, in terms of bringing up the Wagner comparison, because, of course, the providence of the ring of the Nibelung in, again, Wagner's ring cycle is the fact that, like, you know, the ring, there is a primordial element to it. You know, it is forged from the Rheingold at the beginning of the world, you know, by Albrecht, who was spurned by the Rhine maidens. And so the quality of attaining this ring is that you have to forswear love in order to have, you know, total power. And this, you know, in terms of our linkage with The Hobbit again, this has a similar influence in the fact that the ring is part of Fafnir's hoard. You know, as with Beowulf, you know, and as with Smaug, Fafnir is guarding this layer of gold. And Fafnir himself isn't even a dragon. He's a giant wearing the Tarnhelm, which transforms him into the dragon Fafnir. And in terms of, like, the superficial significance, of course, we mentioned the fact that, you know, the early sort of history of the ring. The significant thing about the hobbits regarding the ring is, of course, that the ring has a relatively negligible effect on hobbits compared to the other races, especially the more powerful races such as the Istari, you know, Gandalf being a member and Saruman being a member. And this is very much the interaction with the ring you see from Siegfried, who it almost sees no value from it, even though, again, we will see with Bilbo, there is definitely a corrupting influence, and very much echoes through that with Gollum, who is the much more extreme form of Bilbo when we arrive at Lord of the Rings. So I think, you know, starting with Lord of the Rings, I'd like to build upon this conception of the idea of the ring itself. Would you like to talk about that?
Just before we get to the Lord of the Rings, I think there's another influence on the ring that I just came across the other day, which isn't often mentioned, but I think it's really important, is George MacDonald's The Princess and the Goblin. George MacDonald was a Scottish minister in the Victorian era, but he's most famous for his fairy stories. They were very popular. And he's often credited as the founder of modern fantasy. And he was a big influence on Chesterton, on C.S. Lewis, and probably on Tolkien. Tolkien mentions him in various essays. And in The Princess and the Goblin, which is probably his most famous story, there's a character, the princess is given by her great-grandmother a golden ring. And this ring has a string on it, which she has to follow whenever she's in danger. And this leads her into the mines that the goblins live in so that she can free an individual. I won't go into everything about him, but the point is, like, this ring is very much connected to being in the home of the goblins and then leading her to safety again at various points.
Yeah.
So there's this very strong connection there with themes that you see in The Hobbit of a ring being in the goblin's lair and leading Bilbo to safety at various points. And I think that helps to connect Tolkien's work with the idea that he sees The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings in their own ways as fairy stories. And so that tradition of the, not folk tales, like maybe in the Grimm's fairy stories, as they're called, it's not that sort of thing. It's more like a George MacDonald's fairy stories that he may be getting some influence here on the ring.
Mm. Yes, and I think just to, again, this is a covert way of getting my Wagner stream in with the Tolkien stream. But you mentioned, you know, finding again the ring in the depths of a cave. When it comes to Rheingold, Loki and Wotan descend into Nibelheim, which is, you know, again, kind of like the Wagnerian equivalent of the Misty Mountains. And there, after playing riddles with Albrecht, who is the controller of the ring, Loki is able to trick Albrecht into, you know, assuming a form which would basically make him vulnerable to being captured, and them seizing the ring. And of course, I can't help but see that again, and the riddles told between Gollum and Bilbo at the same time. And again, Gollum believing again that the ring was won by the Hobbit by treachery. And therefore, you know, having this deep-seated hatred of the Hobbit as a result.
There's a very clear connection there. It's almost unmistakable.
Yes. But again, like everything, you know, there is always a slight subversion. There is never, as, you know, Tolkien would say, direct allegory in anything he would say, because, you know, Bilbo is just, you know, a hapless Hobbit trying to survive. He's not a god trying to remove a rival to power, as with Wotan and Loki. But, you know, moving on from that, you know, again, the obvious allusions to ring. Would you say that there is a strong Christian element to the idea of the ring?
Almost undoubtedly. So, really, I think when you, so I've done a fair bit of reading of Tolkien's letters on this sort of issue, and for Tolkien, the ring. Frodo bears it as best he can, but he's struggling with temptation. And this verse in the Lord's Prayer, "Lord, lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil," I think is very clearly played out in the character of Frodo. I won't go into too much detail on that because we're saving that for another stream. But that notion of it's constantly tempting you, and it's almost impossible. Well, spoiler alert, Frodo doesn't, in the end, overcome it. He is overcome by temptation for the ring, even though he does as best, better than anybody else can in probably in the whole of Middle Earth at that time, he's still overcome. And I think that's Tolkien saying everybody falls, which is a very Christian idea he's articulating there. There is nobody without sin.
Yes. I think, and again, this idea with, especially again, going back to Wagner and tying this with some sort of, you know, primordial concept. So the ring is, you know, created by Sauron to, you know, bind all the other rings of power to him. But he himself, you know, is a fallen Maiar who himself, you know, was a disciple of Melkor, who had, you know, dissented from the reign of Ilúvatar. So again, there's a link here essentially between the ring almost being identified with, you know, the original sin, essentially, you know, or the first betrayal against mm-hmm. God. So yes, very much deep Christian elements there.
And as you were alluding to earlier, it's the will to dominate all life. And that's at the very heart of Melkor's rebellion against Ilúvatar in Paradise, essentially, as Satan rebels against God in Paradise Lost. It's very similar, Melkor, and Sauron's lust for power is the same in that regard. So I think that's a very clear connection. I guess another way you could also look at it as an inversion of the incarnation, because with the ring, Sauron pours his own being into this object, and it has its own agency. So it's not a perfect parallel of the incarnation, but there's that sort of idea going on here.
There's definitely an element to it. I think again, I'd like to draw a comparison between, you know, we're principally talking about the books, but I'd like to draw a comparison between the consistency in the films and the books. On the one hand, you could almost say that the concept of the ring is benefited from the film's omission of Tom Bombadil, because even though again. Tom Bombadil is this primordial, you know, this ancient creature who is, you know, referred to as old as Treebeard. Nevertheless, the fact that the ring has no power over him, regardless, it does sort of undermine the concept of, you know, the ring is all corrupting. However, in the film, I think it's important to note that Saruman's motives regarding the ring itself, I mean, his personal motives for survival and teaming up with Sauron are very clear. But his personal motives regarding what he's going to do with the ring when he acquires it from the Fellowship, whether he's going to keep it or give it to Sauron, is never that clear in the film. But in the books, there is definitely this notion, this idea that there is an inner conflict between the orcs allied to Saruman and the orcs allied to Sauron, especially at the beginning of the Twin Towers, and that Saruman would very much like to have the ring so he could depose Sauron. So again, this consistent idea, you know, you mentioned on the idea that, you know, all power corrupts. Within the books, I think there's this idea that the ring could possibly serve another master other than Sauron and could in fact be used to usurp him. Where in the films, again, this falls down a bit, the fact that, as you know, we have with our famous bit, you know, there is only one Lord of the Ring and he does not share power. If the ring can only serve Sauron, then it's not necessarily even a myth about total power, but the desire for total power, because you will never yourself achieve total power. So I think in terms of the actual consistency of the ring, it's also the fact that with The Hobbit, as we mentioned, the origins of the ring itself weren't intended to be this grandiose, that there isn't necessarily this consistency in the idea of the ring. And so as a result, we will be having these discussions about it forever. But I think rather than making this unless you have anything else to add, we'll probably get on to the chronology of the Lord of the Rings itself.
Well, just to say on that point, just briefly, that Gandalf has a really good line in the books, which isn't included in the films, but I think it helps to understand what you've just said, is that Sauron is super intelligent, and he can map out what he thinks the logical moves of the opposition are. And he expects them to come with power, with the ring, to take him on, essentially. That's what he expects Ilúvatar Dorzer to do. That's what he would do. However, Gandalf points out, we don't want him, but that's not the problem. We don't want any master. We don't want anybody to take his place. We want to be free peoples. And he can't understand that. And that's at the heart of what the ring is about, is that's why he can't understand destroying it, because he can't understand not having that sort of mastership over the world, or somebody wanting that mastership over the world.
Yes. And when it comes to Tolkien's interpretation of this, I think Shippey makes an error in referring to this as a fundamentally modern concept. Because again, in terms of like total power, I mean, I've done streams on this myself regarding the conflict between the emperor and the papacy over the control of the spiritual and the temporal realms, and this, you know, desire to achieve power within Christendom itself. I think what Tolkien is referring to is, you know, much deeper than that, you know, rather than just having headship. I think Tolkien is referring to very much the totalitarianism that we see throughout the 20th century, and much of the books could be seen again, you know, in the purest reactionary light, not only, you know, a reaction against the themes of industrialization, which are, you know, so clear with Saruman, but also against the idea of, you know, the absolute totalizing power of, you know, the regimes in World War II, as opposed, again, you could say, to the much more laissez-faire regimes of the Middle Ages. And again, as we go back to even before then, towards the transition of the Anglo-Saxons from paganism to Christianity, this idea of a free Volk, you know, a free people of the Rohirrim, essentially. So in terms of that concept, I think it's, you know, quite difficult really to nail down. And as we mentioned throughout the stream, there will be many sort of competing influences for this. But moving on, if that's all right. So we start off with the chronology. And I think, you know, frustratingly a bit probably about The Lord of the Rings is that it starts off really quite plodding and slow. The Fellowship of the Ring, I'll admit, is the first part is quite a hard bit to get to. And you could almost say that, as with The Hobbit itself, it does self-plagiarize aspects of it in terms of the similar run to Elrond in Rivendell. And I think in terms, you know, other than we will, of course, mention Tom Bombadil, you know, things like The Willow Man and The Barrows, I think, you know, these things don't really sort of add that much in terms of the grand scale of the books and the world building. But one sort of interesting thing I did mention in terms of this, again, alluding to the fact that Tolkien's work wasn't planned out, was the fact that Aragorn was originally supposed to be a hobbit named Trotter, which I never knew about before doing research onto this stream. I just like to imagine how The Lord of the Rings would have changed had that change been made.
That's going to be some weird fan fiction somebody's probably written somewhere.
So anyway, but anyway, I think the sort of dividing point again is reaching the Council of Elrond. And the Council of Elrond is, you know, a very interesting device in the sense that it allows Tolkien to use, again, various forms of language to communicate, you know, the various motivations and the various cultures of, you know, whether they be the Gondorians, whether they be Gloin and Gimli, whether they be Aragorn, of course, representing the Dúnedain. And again, we talk about sort of anachronistic elements, you know, within the Council of Elrond scene, Boromir could be seen, you know, speaking quite a stultified, you know, older variation of English. And, you know, Aragorn himself can almost lapse into some sort of, again, modern English. But I think the Council of Elrond is great at sort of expanding the world and, again, expanding all the different motivations the races have towards this, you know, this great quest that'll go on. In terms of sort of, again, building the world beyond that, we've already mentioned the origin of the elves. There is one point I want to get to, which is, of course, when we go through Moria and we arrive at the other end. I think, you know, in terms of Balrog and the creatures of Melkor, Morgoth, you know, I'd probably like to leave this to a stream on the Silmarillion specifically, in terms of, you know, the original primordial creatures. We've already talked about the origins of the orcs. But when we reach, of course, Lothlórien on the other side, and of course we have the death of Gandalf, and I don't think, again, it's quite obvious what the inspiration is between the death and the resurrection of Gandalf. But when we reach Lothlórien, I'd like to ask you, because again, this is something that I would like to know more and have some sort of superficial understanding about, which is explaining the certain affinity between the elves and the forest. And again, you see this in the Silvan Elves with Thranduil in Mirkwood as well.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Although I think that there is a distinction that needs to be drawn in terms of the elves of Mirkwood, so Thranduil's elves. They have always lived in that part of the world, or Middle-earth. They never went to Valinor, whereas the Elves of Lothlórien, is, well, Galadriel, not her husband, interestingly, but Galadriel, she was in Valinor and then came back with Feanor, and we'll get into that in the Silmarillion, I suppose. But so her affinity comes from the paradise in Valinor, which the gardens there are Lórien. So it's being recreated in Middle-earth as Lothlórien, almost. It's a shadow of the splendor of Valinor. And this connection is tied up with also with the ring that she has. It gives her the power to kind of sustain that land and keep it in its bubble. And that magic from with the ring is tied into nature in this regard. And so with the fading of the rings comes the fading of kind of the magical natural world, which are one and the same thing for Tolkien. So I think there's the connection, really, is, I should also say that the Valar, who, again, I don't want to get too much into, but it's helpful for answering the question, the Valar are each tied to various aspects of the world and cultivating the world. And so you have certain ones which cultivated the gardens of Lórien, or Lórien in Valinor. So the elves, like Galadriel, are somewhat continuing that strand. They are kind of the agents now stewarding the natural world in Middle-earth. So I think that's a deep connection there, within the world at least.
No, wonderful, and thank you for that that allusion. Again, when it comes to the elves in particular, because again, the one of the overarching themes, as Nathan has mentioned, is the idea of, you know, general decline and the passing of time. And we'll be able to really focus on the elves in our Silmarillion stream. But again, when we talk about the elves in the Third Age, it very much is considered to be some sort of afterthought or the last remainder before they finally part the waves and return to the West. When it comes to the again, our next sort of inspiration, I have a passage here, because of course the chronology of course is that they leave Lothlórien, they travel down the Anduil, and they are ambushed by the Uruk-hai at in the service of Saruman at Amon Hen, and that is where we have the breaking of the fellowship. And this is where the party led by, you know, Legolas, Gimli and Aragorn begin to arrive at the borders of the Mark. And this is where I'd really like to talk about Rohan. When it comes to Boromir, yes, we will. I will get back to Boromir when we're talking about Gondor in particular, which will follow on chronologically after Rohirrim. But if I may, there's about sort of five pages here where Tom Shippey really goes into depth regarding the kingdom of Rohan and what it really represents. And if you, because again, it's quite, you know, five pages. If you'd like to make any sort of contributions, just say pause and I'll stop and let you elaborate.
Go for it.
Any one of Tolkien's tableau would stand analysis, and the obvious one to choose is perhaps Gondor. However, I prefer to start with the Riders of Rohan, not the first children of Tolkien's imagination, but the ones he regarded with most affection, and also in a sense the most central. In creating them, Tolkien was once again playing with his own background and his own home in the Little Kingdom. Thus, Rohan is only the Gondorian word for the Riders' country. They themselves call it the Mark. Now, there is no English county called the Mark, but the Anglo-Saxon kingdom, which included both Tolkien's hometown, Birmingham, and his alma mater, Oxford, was Mercia, a Latinism now adopted by historians, mainly because the native term was never recorded. However, the West Saxons called their neighbours the Merci, clearly a derivation from Meac, the Mercians' own pronunciation. Of that would certainly have been the Mark, and there was no doubt once that that was once an everyday term for central England. As for the white horse on the green field, which is the emblem of the Mark, you can see it cut into the chalk 50 miles from Tolkien's study, 2 miles from Wayland Smithy, and just on the borders of Mercia and Wessex, as if to mark the kingdom's end. All the riders' names and the language are Old English, as many have noted, but they were homely to Tolkien in an even deeper sense than that. As has already been remarked, though the riders, according to Tolkien, did not resemble the ancient English, except in a general way, due to the circumstances, a simpler and more primitive people, living in contact with higher and more venerable culture, and occupying lands that had once been part of his domain, Tolkien was stretching the truth a long way in asserting that, to say the least. But there is one obvious difference between the people of Rohan and the ancient English, and that is the horses. The Rohirrim called themselves Eotheot, Eoth or Peod people, horse people. This translates into common speech as the riders. Rohan itself is Sindarin for house horse country. Prominent riders called themselves after horses, Eomond, Eomer, and Eowen. And their most important title after king is Marshal, borrowed into English from French, but going back to an unrecorded Germanic, Marshal Scalots, horse servant. The Rohirrim are nothing if not cavalry. By contrast, the Anglo-Saxons' reluctance to have anything militarily to do with horses is notorious. The Battle of Maldon begins significantly enough, with the horses being sent to the rear. Hastings was lost along with the Anglo-Saxon independence, largely because the English heavy infantry could not quite hold off the combination of archers and mounted knights. The Anglo-Saxon Chronicle entry for 1055 remarks, sourly, that the Hereford, before a spear was thrown, the English fled, because they had been made to fight on horseback. How, then, can Anglo-Saxon and Rohirrim ever be culturally equated? And this is, you know, we're leading on to one of the fascinating themes about Tolkien's inventiveness and his own fascination with Gothic in particular. A part of the answer is that the Rohirrim are not to be equated with the Anglo-Saxons of history, but with those of poetry or legend. The chapter The King of the Golden Hall is straightforwardly Calact on Beowulf. When Legolas says, Medjuseld, the light of it shines far over the land, he is translating line 311 of Beowulf, Dixte se leomne ofe lamdefella. Medjuseld is indeed a Beowulfian word for hall. More importantly, the poem and the chapter agree down to the minute detail on the procedure for approaching kings. In Beowulf, the hero is stopped first by a coast guard, then by a doorward, and only after two challenges is allowed to approach the Danish king. He and his men have to pile arms outside as well. Tolkien follows this dignified, step-by-step ceremonial process exactly. Thus, in The King of the Golden Hall, Gandalf, Aragorn, Legolas, and Gimli are checked first by the guards at the gates of Edoras, and by that extension, that word means enclosures, and then by the doorward of Medjuseld. Hammer, he too insists on the ceremony of piling arms, though Tolkien's characters object more than Beowulf does, largely because he is a volunteer, and in any case fights by choice barehanded. There is a crisis over Gandalf's staff, indeed, and Hammer broods, reflecting rightly that the staff and hand of a wizard may become more than a prop for age. He settles his doubts with the maxim, yet in doubt a man of worth will trust to his own wisdom. I believe you are friends and folk of honour, who have no evil purpose. You may go in. In saying so, he echoes the maxim of the coast guard of Beowulf. A sharp shield warrior must know how to tell good from bad in every case, from words as well as deeds. I hear you, that this is a friendly warband. I will guide you. The point is not, though, that Tolkien is once more writing a Calact narrative, but that he is taking advantage of a modern expansive style to spell out things that would have been obvious to Anglo-Saxons in particular. The truths that freedom is not a prerogative of democracies, and that in free societies, orders give way to discretion. Hammer takes risk with Gandalf, and so the Coast Guard with Beowulf. So does Eomer with Aragorn, letting him go free and lending him horses. He is under arrest when Aragorn reappears, and Theoden notes Hammer's dereliction of duty too. Still, the nice thing about the riders, one might say, is that though a stern people, loyal to their lord, they wear a duty and loyalty lightly. Hammer and Eomer make their own decisions, and even the suspicious Gatewalk wishes Gandalf luck. I was only obeying orders. We can see would not be accepted as an excuse in the Riddermark, nor would it in Beowulf. The wisdom of ancient epic is translated by Tolkien into a whole sequence of doubts, decisions, sayings, and rituals. One could go further and say the riders spring from poetry, not history, and the whole of their culture is based on song. Almost the first thing Gandalf and the others see, nearing Medjuseld, are the mounds covering the Silbamine, either side of the way. Silbamine is a little word for white flower, or ever so, ever mind, or ever memory, forget me not. Like the barrows, it stands for the preservation of the memory of ancient deeds and heroes in the expanse of years. The riders are fascinated by memorial verse and oblivion, by deaths and by epitaphs. They show it in their list of kingly pedigrees, from Theoden back to Eorl the Young, in the suicidal urges of Eomer and Eowyn to do deeds of song, in the song that Aragorn sings to set the tone of the culture he's visiting. Where now the horse and the rider? Where is the horn that was blowing? Where is the helm and the hauberk and the bright hair flowing? Most of all, it comes over the alliterative dirges made for Theoden by Glaoweeni, for the dead of Pelennor by an anonymous maker, even in the rhyming couplet made by the horse Snowmane. These preserve the sonority, the sadness, the feeling for violent opposites, death day, lords, lowly, hall pastures, integrated in the rider's language and culture. Their visual correlatives, one might say, are the spears planted in burial mounds by Fangorn and at the fords of Isen, or perhaps the spears of the men and the mounds of poems, for Eomer says of one burial, when their spears have rotted and rusted, long still their mounds stay and guard the fords of Isen. The men die and their weapons rust, but their memory passes. It remains the forget-me-not, the ever-mind, the oral heritage of the race. Do you have anything to say? I do understand that I've been talking quite a lot, but nevertheless, I think it's quite an interesting passage to go through.
Yeah, that's there's just so much there. I guess the first thing, just to tie it in with a lot of what we've been talking about, is he mentioned how decay, essentially, that although this is a proud culture with long-held traditions, in the character of Theoden and with the way the hall had been, there'd been decline from that. And Eomer and Eowyn desire to return to those glory days. And it's something that hangs over Theoden very much until the end of his life, that he's not lived up to the great heroes of old. And that connects it, I think, very well with the elves, for example, that we were talking about, decay with them too.
As we mentioned, as I mentioned earlier, I wanted to say that passage just because I think it sums up again the continuity between the Anglo-Saxon tradition and that of the invented Rohirrim. However, as we mentioned with the word the mark, and again this being some sort of mythologized version of Mercia, I'll sum up some of the other points he makes. Again, these aren't original assessments by me by any means. Talking about his love of philology, the word, the etymology of horsa, of course, means horse or stallion. Horsa, Hengist, being the mythological founders of the Anglo-Saxons. And it's almost as if, again, the illusion is, because the etymology is there, that one can justify this alternative history, where, despite, as he mentions, the fact that the real Anglo-Saxons had no pedigree when it came to cavalry riding at all. In fact, they would always favor the to fight on foot, throughout their history. Nevertheless, because the etymology is there, it gives it some sort of legitimacy. And so, again, this is sort of defined by the geography as well. Mercia, of course, being on the island of Great Britain, there isn't, again, so much of an impetus for having to learn the ways of horsemanship. However, Tolkien's greatest fascination, other than that of the Anglo-Saxons themselves, was with the Goths. Now, I think I'll get up an image of Middle-earth just to show you what I mean. When talking about the geography here, because I think this is quite significant to talk about. Okay, so here we have a map of Rohan in the center, as you can see. When it comes to the Rohirrim, of course, this is very much a landlocked country, and to the east you can see the open plain. And Rhiannon, of course, to the north. When it comes to, the historical allusions of this territory, there's nothing really resembling England at all in terms of the geography here. Shippey himself argues that this area is actually based on modern day Ukraine, so the area east of the Carpathian Mountains. So if we are going to ascribe the Misty Mountains as, the Carpathian borders, which used to be the natural boundaries of Hungary, and then to the east we have, the rolling steppe towards Crimea and towards Russia. And here, when we have Mirkwood, you could say that this is an allusion to the dark woods of the River Dnieper. And you can say, even though I believe that the Anduin is an inspiration again of the Danube in some instances. I think it's also inspired by the river Dnieper, which is the central river in Ukraine, which runs up, you know, all the way to Belarusia. So here you can almost say that we have this Anglo-Saxon synthesis with the ancient Gothic peoples, who, of course, you know, are great horse riders. And in terms of sort of the etymology we'll sort of get into, this will sort of bleed into our assessment of Gondor. You know, of course, one of the central points that we get to the Return of the King is the fact that the Rohirrim would be instrumental in lifting the siege of Minas Tirith. And this is, you know, really something I want to get back to in terms of the rich inspiration behind this, in terms of, you know, the historical inspiration. It's quite clear that elements of the Battle of Pelennor Fields were inspired by Jordanes' description of the Battle of the Catalunian Plains between the Romans and Attila the Hun in, I think, the year 450. And the interesting thing about that, of course, the general we all remember is Aetius fighting on the Roman side. They were also assisted by the Gothic king, Theodoric. The fascinating thing about the etymology of that is that rex is the Gothic word for king. So it becomes Theodore King, Theoden King, who was slain at the Battle of the Catalunian Plains, as opposed to Theoden King, who was slain at the Battle of the Pelennor Fields. Again, trying to wrap this all together, one of the things that sort of really confused me, though, I mean, other than this being an ode to Tolkien's absolute love of the Gothic culture, and the fact he would, you know, ruminate a lot about the loss of the Gothic culture towards the end of the 15th century. How does one reconcile the relationship between Gondor and Rohan, even if one takes a rather superficial look? We'll get into the inspirations later, because it's really quite complex. But take a superficial example that Gondor is just an imitation of the dying Roman Empire, say, for example, and the Goths, you know, despite helping the Romans at the Battle of the Catalunian Plains, there would also be fierce adversaries throughout this period. And I was thinking, you know, how does one reconcile this? Well, the last vestige of the Goths were, of all places, they were in Crimea, modern-day Crimea, which is now, of course, part of Russia, the Principality of Theodoro, who were the last vassals of the Emperor of Trebizond, who was himself the, you could say, the last emperor of the Roman Empire. So you could say, you know, the last vassal were the Goths, and again, of the Roman Emperor. So there is some sort of tenuous historical link that you can draw between this system of vassalage of Rohan and Gondor, and trying to, again, bring Rohan into some sort of grand sort of Gothic history. Because again, it doesn't really exist if you just look at it as a history of the Mark or a history of Mercia. But again, that's probably ridiculous, and you'll probably like to add something to that.
Not much. That's a really good summary. I think the only thing I would add is, in The Lord of the Rings, there is a rumour that's quickly dispelled that Rohan are sending horses to Mordor, and that perhaps this is an allusion to the Goths having an adversarial relationship at points with Rome, that they're dangerous and they're not just tied in to Gondor, the Rohirrim. They have their own culture, and they're not shouldn't be taken lightly, and they could, in theory, flip. So it's perhaps that's part of it, the instability of that relationship.
Yes, but I think, you know, I think there is something to be said about my tenuous comparison between the Goths in Crimea and the dying days of the Byzantine Empire.
But, I loved it. It was great.
But and as you mentioned, there is, I would say, there is a very different ethnogonic history between Rohan and Gondor, and I really sort of like to get into Gondor and discuss, like, in terms of also the themes and the significance of what Gondor represents. So again, summing up, of course, the chronology as we go through the Two Towers, we have the Battle of Helm's Deep, of course, and throughout this process, this again, this is something I really would like your contributions on, Nathan, which is the symbolism of the Ents, because of course the Ents play a significant role in the demise of Saruman. And again, on the one hand, we have the liberation of the Mark from the constant raids by the evil men, the Dunlanders, and in alliance with Saruman and the Orcs. But in terms of this physical revolt of the natural environment of the ancient order against the, you know, the mechanized, industrialized Isengard, would you like to elaborate on that?
There's not much more to say, I think, in some ways. So the Ents are a personification of nature, and they are the stewards of nature. I think that's an important point. They are the shepherds of the very dangerous forest, and it's by their hand the forest is either kept in bay or let loose. Saruman, in his arrogance and pride, forgets the danger of the natural world, which is not just seen in the trees, it's seen in the mountains. We passed over it, but Cahadras literally repels the fellowship.
Yes.
The natural world has power.
Absolutely.
And Tolkien is wanting us to focus back in on that. And the Ents, so Saruman is basically using the wood of Fangorn to fuel his fires and to create this mechanized society, very much like the society Tolkien would have grown up with, particularly around Moseley, I would add. In Birmingham, there was great industrialization taking place, and this lovely green area that he grew up in was slowly being eradicated through industry. And there's actually, I'll post it in the chat, there's Edgbaston Reservoir, there's a tower very much like Orthanc, and it's a big basin filled with water there, which you can see, I hope, soon. So this is very much his own experience, and the Ents are nature revolting against that and overthrowing it. And I think that's quite a challenging lesson for us, really, in terms of the, you know, we think industry is going to win out, but actually Tolkien's like, no, nature's going to win, and you're going to be humbled at some point, humanity, on this.
Absolutely, even though, again, Saruman is, it's not, again, this isn't, of course, as we can see during the map, the areas, you know, where we have mannish activity, or, you know, even former mannish activity, like up here in Eriador, even though the population is very much dispersed at this point. Saruman, of course, being an Istari, being one of the later Maia to come to Middle Earth, you know, as representatives of Valinor, you know, very much they betray their purpose. And again, this is coming to this idea of, you know, constant biblical themes of allusions back to Lucifer. In terms of sort of moving the chronology on from here, you know, we'll get up to the Siege of Minas Tirith later and sort of elaborate on that point I made and other inspirations I'd like to draw from that, because I don't believe it really stops there. But the hobbits in particular, they pass through the Dead Marshes after having been separated at the Amon Hen, having passed through Emmemuel. And one inspiration I thought is, again, going back to my stream on Monday, if people want to check it out on Ancient Germania, is the bog bodies or the sacrificial practices of the pagans in Jutland and Mecklenburg and Lower Saxony, of that of, again, sometimes willingly, sometimes not, but sacrificing bodies in the bogs and leaving them there, you know, relatively preserved, like Toland Man. You know, one can't help but draw some sort of, you know, allusion to pagan Germanic sacrifices and the Dead Marshes. But they pass through, you know, they get to the Black Gate, and of course they have to turn around, and they pass through the lands of Ithilien. Okay, we've lost Nathan, so I'll continue speaking. Hopefully he'll come back in a bit. We see the hobbits pass through into the lands of Ithilien, and this is where, of course, they have their first interaction with the Gondorians, being that of Faramir and his rangers of Ithilien. At the same time, we have the Rohirrim marshalling for war, at the same time that Gandalf has been brought back to Minas Tirith with Pippin, and he is again ingratiated into the Fountain Guard in the service of the Stuart Denethor. And we're back. Were you able to hear what I was saying?
No, I missed it all. Sorry about that.
All right. Well, just a quick summary of, you know, the chronology. You know, Pippin is now in the service of Denethor. The hobbits are now in Ithilien, and the rest of the Fellowship are again in Rohan mustering for war after the beacons have been lit. And I think, you know, this gets to the history of Gondor, you know, which I really want to sort of elaborate on, because in a way it's much more complex than Rohan. You can say there isn't such a direct inspiration, which is so obvious, that in Rohan being, of course, the synthesis of the Gothic and the Anglo-Saxon cultures of Mercia. Gondor, of course, is the descendant of Numenor, and you know you can almost say the allegory there is most obvious when Tolkien is writing about the fall of Numenor, which is the, you know, destruction of the city Atlantis because it offended the gods. The Numenoreans then arrive on the shores of Gondor, and many are enslaved to the cause of Sauron. And then, of course, you know, we have the War of the Last Alliance, which the King Elendil, the Numenorean King Elendil, wins. And there, at the beginning of the First Age, we have the establishment of the kingdoms of Gondor and Arnor. Now, in terms of trying to like understand the greatest significance of this, I would recommend to the chat that you read Evela and think, as you're reading Evela, as to how this pertains to the conception of an idealized fantasy setting, essentially. Because many of the themes you'll see in Tolkien cross over into Evela. And this is a interesting passage I have from Evela, which is in a lesser known book, which is the Hermetic tradition, which is talking about the symbolism of the Tree of Life. So at the beginning of the Kingdom of Gondor, after Sauron is defeated originally, and Elendil comes back and he plants the first white tree of Gondor. I really want to sort of go into the significance of the tree. It's only two pages, but I think it's worth reading nevertheless. In the Vedas and the Upanishads, we find the world tree, inverted sometimes to suggest the origin of its power in the heights, in the heavens. Here we discover a real convergence of many elements and ideas. From this tree drips the nectar of immortality, soma or amrita, and whoever sips it is inspired with a vision beyond the reaches of time. A vision that awakens the memory of all the infinite forms of existence. In the foliage of the tree hides Yama, the god of beyond, the grave, whom we also know as the king of the primordial state. In Iran, we also find the tradition of the double tree, one of which comprises, according to the Bundashesh, all seeds, while the other is capable of furnishing the drink of immortality and spiritual knowledge. Which leads us immediately to think again of the two biblical trees of paradise, the one of life and the other of knowledge. The first, then, is the equivalent to the representation of the kingdom of heaven, sprouts from the seed irrigated by the man, the symbolic field. We encounter it again in the Apocalypse of John, and especially in the Kabbalah, as the great and powerful tree of life, by which life is raised on high, and which is connected a sprinkling by virtue of which is produced the resurrection of the dead, a patent equivalent to the power of immortality in the Vedic Amrita and the Iranian Hamoah. Assyrian-Babylonian mythology also recognizes a cosmic tree, rooted in Eridu, the house of profundity or the house of wisdom. What is important to recognize in these traditions, because this element... Sorry, we seem to have lost Nathan again. But what is important to recognize in these traditions, because this element will be useful in what follows, is another association of symbols. The tree also represents for us the personification of the Divine Mother, of that same type of those associated with the Asiatic goddesses of nature, Ishtar, Anat, Tammuz, Sibyl, and so forth. We find then the idea of a feminine nature of the universal force represented by the tree. This idea is not only confirmed by the goddess consecrated to the Duma oak, which besides being a place of oracles, it's also a fountain of spiritual knowledge, but also by the Hesperides, who are charged with guarding the tree, whose fruits has the same symbolic value as the golden fleece, and the same immortalizing power as the tree of the Irish legend of Magmel, also guarded by a feminine entity. In the Edda, and again the Edda, the poetic Edda being so central to Tolkien's mythology, it is the goddess Idhun who is charged with guarding the apples of immortality, while in the cosmic tree, Yggdrasil, again we encounter the central symbol rising before the mountain of Mimir, guarding it, reintroducing the symbol of the dragon at the root of the tree, which contains the principle of all wisdom. Finally, according to Slavic saga, on the island of Bajan, there is an oak guarded by a dragon, which we must associate with the biblical serpent, with the monsters of Jason's adventures, and with the Garden of Hesperides, that simultaneously is the residence of a feminine principle, the Virgin of Dawn. Also rather interesting is the variation according to which the tree appears to us as the dominion of the universal empire, such as we find in the legends, like those of Holger and Prester John, whom we have mentioned elsewhere. In these legends, the tree is often dubbed the tree of the sun and the tree of the moon. Hermeticism repeats the same primordial symbolic tradition and the same association of ideas, and the symbol of the tree is quite prevalent in alchemical texts. The tree shelters the fountain of Bernard of Treviso, in which center is the symbol of the dragon, Ouroboros, who represents the all. It personifies Mercury, either as the first principle of the Hermetic opos, equivalent to the divine water or water of life, that gives resurrection to the dead and illuminates the son of Hermes, or else it represents the lady of the philosophers, but it also represents the dragon, that is, a dissolving force, a power that kills. The tree, the sun, and the tree of the moon are also hermetic symbols, sometimes producing crowns in the place of fruits. This quick glance at the stuff of religion, which we could expand on indefinitely, is enough to establish the permanence and universality of a tradition of vegetable symbolism, expressing the universal force predominantly in the feminine form. This symbolism is the repository of a supernatural science of a force capable of giving immortality and dominion, but at the same time warns of multiple danger that complicates the myth in terms of various purposes, different truths and visions. In general, the danger is the same to anyone runs in seeking the conquest of immortality or enlightenment. By contacting the universal force, the one who makes contact must be capable of withstanding overwhelming grandeur. We also know myths in which there are heroes who confront the tree, and divine natures in the Bible, God himself is hypostasized, that defend and impede access to it. And the result then is a battle variously interpreted according to the traditions. There is a double possibility in one case. The tree is conceived as temptation, which leads to ruin and damnation for anyone who succumbs to it. The other, it is conceived as an object of possible conquest, after which dealing with the dragons or divine beings, defending it, transforms the darer into a god and sometimes transfers the attributes of divinity or immortality from one race to another. Thus, the knowledge that tempted Adam to become as God, and that he attained only by immediately being knocked down and deprived of the tree of life, by the very being with whom he had hoped to equalize himself. Now, I think the significance is incredibly clear, and I'll wait for Nathan to come back. Hopefully he will be come back, so he won't just have to listen to me monologuing for the rest of the stream. But I think the significance is clear, especially when we see in the conquest on the destruction of the tree, that we have a tree which is, you know, rich in this incredible biblical, again, idea with the original corruption of man, but also as the tree of life, as representing the dominion, and not just any dominion, the dominion of man and the civilization of the Numenoreans itself as beginning this new civilization anew. And the symbolic conquest of this tree by Sauron would essentially represent the transition of some sort of universal sovereignty, universal dominion, to that of Sauron himself. And again, bringing this back to the idea that the tree represents some sort of parallel with the ring itself, where you have the original fall, where one wants to equalize and usurp the position of God. In the case of the Lord of the Rings universe, this would be, again, followed up by Melkor as well, and possibly even by Saruman, had the plot of the Lord of the Rings gone a different way, which is the usurpation of Ilúvatar. And in this case, it would mean the dominion of all Middle-earth, as represented by holding that tree, the white tree of Gondor. So as you can see, there is absolutely significant in wonderful way of Nathan, you're back. You sadly missed, unless you were listening, the analysis given by Evola. But essentially, the tree represents temptation. It represents some sort of equivalency with the ring. It harkens back to the original fall of Adam, but it also represents dominion, in this case, dominion of man, but also the roots of all civilization, I think. Nathan?
Sorry, I cut out for a while, so I don't know how much I missed of what you just said. I think technology was...
All right, I think I
don't have much to add.
Okay, well, I thought it was an interesting point regardless, in terms, again, just bringing Evola into this and trying to see this as part, not just of a particular tradition to the Anglo-Saxons, of course, you know, a European tradition, so which Tolkien himself is well-versed, but this, in fact, represents a universal tradition, the significance, the biblical significance of the tree itself, the tree of life. and the significance of the Gondorians, and how this is both, you know, the inception of the new Gondorian civilization post the fall of Numenor, post the Last Alliance, and how this was a symbol of conquest by Sauron, and how taking this tree would not only represent, again, the end of the dominion of man and the beginning of his dominion, but represent some sort of parallel with the ring and the original fall, you know, as with the tree of knowledge and the tree of life in paradise. But sort of moving on from that, because I don't want to linger too much on that on that point, is when talking about Gondor, of course, we've also mentioned that Gondor has some similarities to the Roman Empire. And I feel that this comparison is rather superficial. I mean, I'll give you the overall reasoning for it. Of course, you know, Gondor represents the height of human civilization. And in terms of, again, trying to, this is primarily a historical channel, trying to bring this back to historical inspiration. When we have the establishment of the Kingdom of Men by Elendil, there are two kingdoms, not just one. We have Gondor, which is ruled by the House of Eanor, which is the younger son of Elendil. And we have Arnor, which is going to be inherited by the House of Isildur, who, of course, is the first son of Elendil. I think you can see that there is some sort of comparison with this. I would draw the, you know, in terms of if Elendil is to be any Roman emperor, I'd probably say he represents Constantine. But you could also say that he represents Theodosius, because Theodosius is able to definitively divide the Roman Empire between his two sons, Arcadius and Honorius. And you can see that in the division of the empire itself. And of course, the allusions to Arnor being some sort of representative of the Western Roman Empire, you know, there are quite a lot of influences. The fact that it collapses politically, it divides, as we see, you know, throughout the crisis of the third century, even though this will be before the eventual, you know, terminal decline, that the Western Roman Empire was split off into the Gallic Empire. In the case of Tolkienian and the Tolkien Legendarium, this would be the, correct me if I'm wrong, but the division of Arnor into the Kingdom of Rudar, the Kingdom of Cardolan, and Athedain. Am I correct there?
I think
the
so,
three
yeah.
The three successive kingdoms of Arnor, which would eventually be Rudar would be assimilated into Angmar, and Angmar would lead the conquest of Arnor itself, and therefore we have the symbolic, you know, loss of the Western Roman Empire. Tolkien himself would refer to Arthedain. Thank you, JD in the chat. Tolkien himself would refer to Minas Tirith as a Byzantine history, as a Byzantine city, and I mean, if you just look at it, just get up the image here. This, of course, is the Tolkien is the adaptation by Peter Jackson in the films. I really don't get that much of a, especially just in the geography, regardless of the actual design of the city itself, which, you know, could be seen as, you know, rather Jacksonian rather than that of Tolkien. The geography itself lends nothing to the idea that this is some sort of Byzantine city, or this has some sort of comparison with Byzantium itself, because it's so departed again from the water, which is, you know, so significant. I mean, my own reading of the significance of Minas Tirith is that it could be an allusion to several things. You know, one, of course, is an allusion to the city of Rome. One, of course, is an allusion to Jerusalem, that Gondor and the Numenorians represent some sort of Christian civilization. And this is, you know, in terms of the influence, and as we see Middle Earth as an extension of language and language play, I think the language is Adunaic, Adunaic or something, the Numenorean language. There are Semitic influences, especially in the calligraphy, which, you know, very much looks Hebrew. We have inspiration, of course, from the Germanic aspect, and we have, again, obvious allusions to Rome. But nevertheless, I mean, in terms of sort of pitting this down, you know, I really see very little of ancient Rome or Greece represented in the culture. I mean, one interesting thing to note is there are obvious Germanic influences in the death of Boromir, for example, the funeral pyre on the boat, you know, again, very much reminiscent of the Norse sagas, that there is a Germanic element to this kingdom. But on the other hand, talking about the Semitic influences, on the one hand, we have the fall of Numenor. Evela would regard this as some sort of fusion between the Western influences and Northern influences, the Atlantic civilization versus the Hyperborean civilization. But I think that's a bit too complicated, really, to get into that much depth on the stream. But to say, you know, one could draw the comparison between the fall of Numenor and that being like the fall of Troy, and this being, you know, the passage of Aeneas, the Iliad, and the creation of the city of Rome. But I think, you know, one could also draw, you know, if we're going to go the Semitic route, that this could be, as we see with the great seafaring tradition of the Numenoreans, that there could be some sort of, you know, Punic or Carthaginian influence there. And that's very much as we have, you know, the departing of Aeneas. On the other side, we have the departing of Queen Dido. And this could represent some sort of, again, Punic retreat. In terms of this building upon the Semitic influence from Gondor, you know, the Phoenicians and the Carthaginians is one aspect. But another one I'd like to draw is that it being a allusion to a Christian civilization as a whole. And by that, I would refer to it as being an allegory to some extent of the kingdom of Israel. And the sort of the inspiration I have for this is the fact that, unlike in Roman history, we have a very long period of Middle Earth history where Gondor is ruled by the House of Húrin, who are the House of Stuarts. Now, this, there's no real equivalent in Roman imperial history, you know, after the creation of the empire, where this happens, where you have the fall of the king, essentially, you know, the end of the House of Ainur and the dissolution of Arnor. So what does, where does one draw the inspiration? You know, one could say that Elendil or Isildur is some sort of allusion to King David, and, you know, by extension, the corruption of King Solomon. And that, as with the kingdom of Israel, Israel itself, again, split into two kingdoms, like, you know, Arnor and Gondor. And much of, you know, Jewish messianic tradition, the Jewish prophecy, which, of course, is so entwined with Christianity, is out of waiting for a Messiah, or in some cases, waiting for the return of the king after the House of Kings has fallen, after the House of David has fallen. And you could almost say that it's been usurped by this lesser house, you know, this paranoid house, which is almost to the point of making an alliance with the enemy. One could even draw a comparison with Herod the Great and Denethor. And again, goes totally mad and, you know, starts seeing threats everywhere. So, and of course, Aragorn being the typified messianic figure, you know, the return of the king. Do you think I'm reading too much into that, or I'm missing something there in terms of the illusions?
I think I could just add one thing that would maybe confirm what you've just said, actually, is that if you look at the New Jerusalem in Revelation, it's a city with seven levels. And I think Minas Tirith is a city with seven levels. So there's definitely an identification there with Jerusalem, and not yet fulfilled until the king returns. So, I think what you've laid out makes a lot of sense.
Interesting. So I think, you know, in terms of sort of building upon this influence, I really want to get up to the, you know, chronology of Lord of the Rings, and this is where it gets even more complicated, and I'm going to draw in even more influences from Gondor. So I'll get this image up a second. Now, this is a visualization of not obviously the film visualization, but a visualization of Minas Ithil. Now, just to, you know, give you a quick chronology, after, you know, we arrive at Gondor and Return of the King. The beginning of the invasion of Gondor by Mordor commences here at Minas Ithil, which is transformed by the Witch King of Angmar into Minas Morgul. And from here, we commence the invasion of Osgiliath and the siege of Minas Tirith, and eventually the Battle of Pelennor Fields. Now, in terms of, I was really trying to wrap my head around this, because I, on the one hand, you know, we've mentioned the fact, you've drawn that brilliant allusion between, you know, Minas Tirith for the New Jerusalem as being more pertinent than that of a Roman equivalent. I really want to sort of move beyond there as well and say there is another historical allusion, not necessarily a theological allusion to that, which is 1683, the Turkish attempt to conquer Vienna. And I think I have quite a lot to substantiate this. As, you know, the diehard Tolkien fans in the chat will know, Minas Tirith wasn't the original capital of Gondor. The original capital was Osgiliath. And to my mind, if there is to be such, you know, focus placed on the city of Minas Tirith, the city of the guard, it doesn't really make much sense as to why Tolkien would choose Osgiliath to also be the capital of Gondor. And as we know, in the beginning of the First Age, Ithilien, which is on the east bank of the Anduin, was also held by the Gondorians, and most of Mordor, in fact, most of the construction of Mordor was Gondorian. And then you see the slow conquest of that region as the regime in Gondor declines by the forces of Mordor. And I really want to focus here at Minas Ithil, because, of course, the etymology of Ithilien is, I think, land of the moon. And so Minas Ithil will be the city of the moon. Now, dispelling the idea that Minas Tirith could really be Constantinople, as opposed to, you know, some sort of allusion to Jerusalem or something else, the symbol of Constantinople was the moon, the crescent moon. And of course, it was conquered in 1453 by the Turks, and the moon was then appropriated to be the crescent moon of Islam. And so we have at the beginning of Minas Ithil, the beginning of the conquest or would-be conquest of Minas Tirith, starting from the city of the moon, i.e. Constantinople, i.e. Istanbul. And they moved to take Osgiliath. Now, Osgiliath is situated on the Anduin. Why is it such a significant city? Why is it a potential capital? Because I think it represents possibly an allusion to the old city of Budapest, the capital of Hungary, and that, it, again, being the capital of the Kingdom of Hungary, which was, you know, destroyed by, kind of, again, like Angmar, destroyed and ripped into pieces by the Turks after the Battle of Mohács. So from this base at Budapest, the old capital, they go and attack Vienna, Vienna being the capital of the Holy Roman Empire, the capital of the House of Habsburg, the center of the Mannish dominion or the Christian dominion in Europe after the fall of the original city of Constantinople, or in this case would be the Minas Ithil, which again was a city bordering the Alps, you know, just before the, even the geography looks quite similar if you were to plop Vienna on a map and compare it to, at the end of the Alps. And from there, we have the attempted siege. And of course, we have the failure of that siege. And this is why, again, I think it plays into the chronology. And at Pelennor Fields, of course, we have the Gondorians or the Holy Alliance. Again, this isn't just, you know, the Austrians fighting. This is a Holy Alliance of, you know, most, you know, factions of the Holy Roman Empire fighting against the common enemy. In this case, it will be the Turks. And again, the Turks aren't just, you know, represented by themselves, but they also form various alliances with, you know, among other groups such as the Crimeans. And, you know, of course, it's a multi-ethnic empire, and this could be seen as a coalition, as exemplified in Lord of the Ring, between the Haradin and the Easterlings and the Barbary Corsairs. Of course, I think it's obvious that that is an allusion to the Barbary Corsairs, the course, you know, of North Africa, of Algeria, of Tunisia, which again were vassals of the Ottoman Sultanate. So to build on this further, after the battle, the siege of Minas Tirith is lifted, and we have the Battle of Pelennor Fields, who arrives to save the day at the Battle of Pelennor Fields? It is the Rohirrim. So you could say that not only is Théoden an allusion to Theodore Rakes at the Battle of the Catalonian Fields, but he is also an allusion to Jan Sobieski, the King of Poland, who led a very famous cavalry charge that dispersed the besiegers. I believe it was at the Kahlenberg. So I think I'm right in saying that there are a lot of historical allusions that one can draw, and especially in the fact that I can't pin any sort of obvious comparison in terms of the progression of the story of Return of the King, where we have, you know, such a massive rollback on all these centuries of Turkish conquest throughout Central Europe, as we see with the reconquest of much of Ithilien and Gondor after the, you know, the new age of Elisar, again, the second name for Aragon. What do you think of that, that summary I've made?
I think it's really good, and I didn't know any of that before, so thank you for sharing that. That was wonderful. The only thing, if I may add, is a mythological comparison with Minas Tirith, because they're twin cities, as you alluded to. So in Revelation, you've got the New Jerusalem, but you've also got Babylon. And if I may just, there's a few verses in Revelation 18, which I think exactly sound like Minas Morgul. So from verse 2, "Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great. She has become a dwelling for demons and a haunt for every impure spirit, a haunt for every unclean bird, a haunt for every unclean and detestable animal. For all the nations have drunk the maddening wine of her adulteries. The kings of the earth committed adultery with her, and the merchants of the earth grew rich from her excessive luxuries." If we think the ring race are kings of men who have basically pledged allegiance to Sauron for power, they have committed adultery with the great evil.
Hmm.
This Babylon here is Minas Morgul, and it's in direct contrast to the New Jerusalem of Minas Tirith. So I love how you've just given a fantastic array of historical sources, and Tolkien's blending it with the mythology, and it brings it to life, both parts to life in this kind of wonderful fantasy. It's truly amazing.
Absolutely. And I think if nothing else, it's testament to the incredible richness, depth and variety of the inspirations you can see on Tolkien. And really, you know, one can read Tolkien in so many ways. You know, mine is just one reading, of course. And I wouldn't like to imply that it's necessarily the correct one. You know, it's important to note that Tolkien studies is a bona fide, you know, academic branch, and has been for quite some time. And there is, of course, even an academic journal dedicated to Tolkien studies called Mythlore. And in terms of, you know, reading about this, I've mentioned Tom Shippey, but of course there is the Tolkien Encyclopedia, which is, you know, very extensive. And also, I think it's important to mention that in terms of the actual source material beyond just The Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit, as you mentioned, The Third Age, we were very lucky in the fact that Christopher Tolkien succeeded his father in preserving and editing much of his notes to give us, you know, so many of the successive editions of, you know, The Silmarillion and the Unfinished Tales. And I think just the point we want to make across is an incredibly rich world, and it's incredibly deserving to just, again, research more and delve into the source material or draw these historical allusions, because it will just get richer and richer and again, more extensive. And I don't think there's any way of exhausting the amount of material you can get from Tolkien.
You could literally do thousands of streams on it and never cover all of it. It's amazing.
And indeed, there are channels that have done thousands and thousands of streams. This is just our first dip into the subject. You mentioned before we came on that you were willing to make some sort of overarching analysis of the thematic thread behind the story itself. And, you know, very much I've been referring to the historical allusions of the country, of, you know, what one can draw from. I have to try and find out how I'm going to access my super chats, because something's gone wrong here. Would you be able to again give us your insight into the significance of the narrative itself?
Sure. Although, as you indicated before, this is a contested point of view, and not every scholar is going to agree with this or every fan. But this is my reading of kind of the theological framework which underpins the whole of The Lord of the Rings, being deeply Christian. And let me indicate with a couple of passages which might lead us on towards it. So when Gandalf first tells Frodo about the ring, or explains the significance of the ring to Frodo, he talks about how it abandoned Gollum and became Bilbo's in the Mines of Moria, which is told in The Hobbit. And he has this very interesting passage where he says, "Behind that, which is the ring leaving Gollum, there was something else at work, beyond any designs of the ringmaker. I can put it no plainer than by saying that Bilbo was italicized, meant to find the ring, and not by its maker, in which case you also were meant to have it. And that may be an encouraging thought." Now, if we get to the end of The Hobbit, there's another interesting passage here. Right at the end, Bilbo is talking about the prophecies of the old songs, where the rivers are flowing with gold. Of course, Smaug has been defeated, and the gold of the Lonely Mountain is being dispersed across Dale. And he's kind of mocking the idea that the prophecies have come true. And Gandalf said, "And why should not they prove true? Surely you don't disbelieve the prophecies because you had a hand in bringing them about yourself? You don't really suppose, do you, that all your adventures and escapes were managed by mere luck, just for your sole benefit? You are a very fine person, Mr. Baggins, and I'm very fond of you, but you are only quite a little fellow in a wide world after all." These two passages indicate that there's a certain kind of fate or providence going on within the Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
And I don't want to get into it fully because I'm aware this will probably be very much covered in the Silmarillion discussion. But I'm just going to indicate there's one final passage which I think maybe hints towards where it's going, and it's in a letter by Tolkien to dated in 1956, where he's talking about the very end of, or the climax of the story, where Frodo fails to destroy the ring, but then Gollum takes it and in his delight and is dancing away, falls over the edge.
Yeah.
"Frodo deserved all honour because he spent every drop of his power of will and body. And that was just sufficient to bring him to the destined point and no further. Few others, possibly no others of his time, would have got so far. The other power then took over, the writer of the story, by which I do not mean myself, that one ever-present person who is never absent and never named." So there's a supernatural agency guiding the story in some way for Tolkien. It's not ever explicitly explained in The Lord of the Rings. And the nature of the story itself, Tolkien explains in his lecture on fairy stories. And to summarize, it's a eucatastrophe.
Yeah.
It's a reversal of disaster. But at the moment of greatest crisis, grace intervenes unlooked for. And this parallels or is a shadow of the Christian story, where at the point of sin, where damnation looks inevitable, Christ enters history. The incarnation becomes thing. It's the grace unlooked for, and the resurrection is the reversal of the crisis of the crucifixion.
Yeah.
And this is the fundamental story of The Lord of the Rings, which is guided by this providential power. So you can see that there's a, even though it's never kind of shoved in your face in the way that I think C.S. Lewis tries to do with the Narnia stories, for Tolkien, the whole narrative of The Lord of the Rings is guided by a supreme power which is intent on resolving the story in a way that produces joy and consolation.
It's interesting. I think... again, this idea of the guiding hand, or you know, the theological interpretation of history, is something I'm really delving into at the moment. A lot of people have been again delving into this idea that one could read Tolkien's work as inherently, you know, commenting on one could say the degeneration of the world and the passing of the world into new sort of almost infantile forces and hands of men, especially. I would almost say that one could read it either way. You know, one could read it as, you know, the inspiration of, you know, some divine being, you know, whether that be Ilúvatar, or, you know, the ever-present sort of influence of the Ainur, or, you know, something else, you know, or the Valar, or something else entirely, or whether this is actually, in a way, you know, this represents a tragedy, because, of course, at the end, we do have the parting of the elves, and we do have the parting of Frodo into the lands of eternal light, into the lands of Valinor. And there is a part of me which does sort of read Lord of the Rings as a tragedy, even though you do have that, you mentioned your catastrophe in the moment of crucifixion, of course, in addition to the hobbits fulfilling their duty, and whether that again be that be due to luck or anything, Tolkien's subversion of that trait of the classic hero as represented through the hobbits is certainly fascinating. But of course, we do have the slight subversion of the trope of the return of the king, which is Aragorn. So at the moment, you have a hint of joy in the sense that the hobbits have fulfilled that task, but in the sense that you do have that hint of tragedy in the fact that again, Frodo will never truly heal from this. And I'd like to talk about this more than when we get really into the depth of the characters, because the characters, again, are fascinating and multi-layered. But I think there are two readings, one that there is a benevolent force, but one that there is a fundamental tragic aspect to the Lord of the Rings. And, you know, as we pass into the Fourth Age, we are passing into the fundamentally into the unknown, a world which is, you know, completely foreign to, say, the era of the First Age.
I don't think the two readings are incompatible.
I don't believe they're incompatible. I believe they go side by side. Mm-hmm. It's just a matter of which one you draw more emphasis on, I suppose, in the same way that one can say that one can draw a pagan reading and a Christian reading from the sources. And oddly enough, they go hand in hand. They don't they don't conflict with each other. And again, this is just fascinating elements of the, you could almost say, the paradoxes of Tolkien, the fact that you can add these juxtaposing elements all at the same time. I mean, I just mentioned all the juxtaposing elements which make up Gondor itself and what could it represent. And yet, as I mentioned at the beginning, it's all this inspiration, all of these different sources which Tolkien's relied on, this massive body of research all coming together. And yet, despite all the little anachronisms, you know, we mentioned the Shire in particular being a form of anachronism, it manages to create a cohesive unity, a creative whole, which is incredibly satisfying. And the more you look into it, I mean, with so much bad literature, the more you read into it, you know, the more you can just pick apart and, you know, tear apart the world. I mean, Harry Potter is a good example of this. It's something that you know, I read as a child, and ever thinking back on it, I just, there are little elements of brilliance in there, but when one thinks about it, one just has to tear it apart, essentially. But go back to Lord of the Rings, I'm just always overjoyed and fascinated and always inclined to learn more about the world. And it's not just reading Tolkien, you're just not reading Tolkien, but you're reading his magisterial understanding of history and mythology as well. And it's all being imprinted through this work. You know, you could almost say that the fantasy work is an extension of his, again, his intellectual pursuits as well, which is why it's such a fascinating work, which is always so endearing. So yes, I wouldn't say that the tragic element and the element of joy are in any way juxtaposed. Like I said, there is they are juxtaposed, of course, but there is this weird consistency, there is this weird unity which Tolkien is able to achieve, which I think is part of his genius.
Very much so, and if just to add to that, in his lecture on fairy stories, one of the things that Tolkien really wants to emphasize is that, in his view, all mythology points towards, or is a kind of, has the same substance as the gospel for him. It's the same, the gospel or the life of Jesus Christ is mythology and history come together. Mm. I think you can see that very much in the Lord of the Rings. But that doesn't mean mythology gets done away with. It points towards those truths that he believes in. Mm. So that's how I think he's quite happy to harmonize, because in his view, they're not distinct sorts of things. They're one and the same.
One can see it, in terms of the variations of history, despite the fact, you know, I come from a background of academic history, I am more drawn and more interested in what you could call the theogony or theogonic history or ethnogonic history, which again is the historical element where, you know, very much typified before the 18th century, so to speak, which is this idea that there has to be some sort of, you know, teleology, or there has to be some sort of underlying story element or some sort of cohesive whole to a structure. And I think Lord of the Rings, you could say, is one of the most perfect theogonic histories of a civilization that doesn't exist. And that's what's, you know, truly amazing about it.
Well put.
So I think unless you have anything else to say, like we said, we'll probably come back and do a stream going through each of the characters. And also we mentioned this is the third age stream, so we'll very much like to come back possibly as well and come and debate the significance of the Silmarillion. I mean, we've done this out of order. We've done this really in order of publication rather than order of chronology. I mean, just a little note about the Silmarillion versus the Lord of the Rings. One thing which is important to note about the background of Lord of the Rings is that it was really an accident in many sense. You know, you could say the Silmarillion was a work of 60 years that was never finished. I mean, the Silmarillion we have was published posthumously and edited by Christopher Tolkien in 1977. Tolkien died in 1973. When it comes to the Lord of the Rings itself, the reason we have it essentially is because of the success of The Hobbit. And that's why in The Hobbit, you know, we have such a, we have various editions of The Hobbit. The first edition, of course, is the most anachronistic when viewed as, you know, part of a whole with The Lord of the Rings. Even in the naming conventions, you could say, you know, compared to the rich naming conventions in the overall Tolkien legendarium, The Hobbit is quite lazy, as it was intended to be a children's story. And yet from this, you know, children's story, this accident, we have The Lord of the Rings. And one of the things that Tolkien looked back on The Hobbit is that he wished he could rewrite it entirely to make it part of this consistent whole with The Lord of the Rings, which, you know, was incidental and pushed by his publisher. But really, you know, The Silmarillion was the grand project, because it incorporates more of these elements. And, you know, the tragedy being, you know, it was never finished. So we'll try and cover that at a later point. But going to the super chats, the Purple Born for $10 Canadian, a little money for a new streaming computer. I hope you'll talk about the poetry and songs that are integral to Lord of the Rings that are left out of the movies. Now, when it comes to the poetry and songs, obviously we'd be mentioning, you know, all the inspirations behind it. When it comes to the, you know, the wonderful literature itself, I mean, maybe because again, this is an evolving subject, you know, Tolkien studies is such, as we mentioned, such an expansive area. We could, you know, agree on a couple of poems, and we can really dissect them and try and find all the inspirations behind them. That might be quite a nice relaxing stream to do. If that's all right with you at some point, Nathan.
It sounds excellent. I would just add as well, that with the Silmarillion discussion, the role of music and poetry will be very much dissected. So it's very, if you're interested in that, that would be worth tuning in for, because it's integral to the very fabric of Middle-earth.
Absolutely. King Cribble for £5 has said, please delve into the Atlanteans, Cro-Magnons, and the Numenoreans of Umbar and Middle-earth versus the Hyperborean theory that I know so little about. This is, I'm not sure, again, I have seen articles written about, and I've read articles written about Evola and Tolkien, but in terms of this theory, this is something I considered when I was reading through Revolt of the Modern World again rather recently. Which is talking about the different origins and the different like civilizational poles of the Numenoreans versus the Germanic people. So we're talking about the Rohirrim and possibly even the Hobbits. I think the only sort of thing I can really make in addition to the points I've already made, apart from again the Western theory applying to the more Semitic peoples and the possible allusion to Atlantis, is that in that theory there is always this constant allusion to crossing over the Western Ocean and the Atlantic into a world which is transcendent and beyond all comprehension. And I think that's very obvious in the sense that we have in Valinor. But more so, the Hyperborean idea in particular focuses on this all civilization dwelling, you know, from the far north, you know, from the cold and coming down. And but also there is this reference in it to again Midgard, which draws into the Germanic mythos, which you talked about with the etymology of Middle Earth, but also this island, which was supposed to be north of Great Britain, which is supposed to be, you know, where the gods dwelt. I mean, there's even some hypothesis that Britain itself was an incredibly sacred island, and that this, you know, Tolkien himself was, you know, profoundly aware that this Hyperborean theory could correspond, you know, to England itself, and that England could have some sort of transcendent sacred experience. I think in many ways, part of his reason for writing was to find an English mythology. You know, it comes across more in the Silmarillion than it does in Lord of the Rings. So, you know, one can say that The Hobbits is an allusion to, I wouldn't say mythology, I would say it's just an allusion to pre-conquest life, even though it's done through the vein of early modern history, as we talked about. But when it comes to, you know, Tolkien had like an obsession, an overriding obsession with trying to come up with a uncorrupted pre-conquest form of, you know, English culture, which existed between the 6th and the 11th centuries. I think this would have very much added into that, and it's something which I've only just really begun to scratch the surface of, so I have to do much more research on that. But I know that Tolkien did try and come up with a primordial god who would be like the father of Hengist and Horsa. I think the god of the sea and the waves, known as, I think he created the god Ing, who would essentially be, you know, the primordial god who would produce Hengist and Horsa. But, you know, like I said, you know, Tolkien himself only scratched the surface, and even though he played around with this idea, and I'm sure Evelyn would have recognized at the same time, it's important to note that these two people were working contemporaneously, you know, at the same time. A lot of stuff to consider. Nathan, do you have anything to say on that?
No, I just want to tell you that I told you so, that people would be interested in this and you should do more work on it.
Yes.
Such a fascinating illusion.
Absolutely. Well, I'll say that's a good sort of exactly 2 hours. That's a good mark to end it, unless Nathan, you wanted to say anything else before we go.
Just say it's been a pleasure, and I can't wait for the next one.
Absolutely. I'll give you an opportunity then to show your superb channel.
Oh, well, check out my channel. I hope in the next couple of weeks to do a video examining some of the ways that we can undergo spiritual transformation, or what might be involved in that process. So come along and check out.
Wonderful. And I can't recommend his channel enough. Thank you all very much for listening. In terms of future streams, we have a stream on the Great Migrations next Monday at 9:00. And in 2 weeks' time, we will be having a heterodox stream on Homer, so looking into the Iliad and the Odyssey with Columba. Again, moving on this this theme with delving into mythologies and epic poetry. You know, quite an interesting tangent we've gone on. And like I said, we'll hopefully come back in a few weeks' time and do that character assessment of the Third Age. Thank you all very much for listening, and good night.